considerably higher in babies weighing more than 9 pounds. For that reason, mothers who have uncontrolled diabetes, gestational diabetes, or diabetes developed before pregnancy are more likely to encounter this complication during delivery. The chances also rise if your pregnancy has gone past 40 weeks, since babies who arrive late are likely to be on the larger side, or if you've previously delivered a baby with shoulder dystocia. Still, many cases of shoulder dystocia occur during labors without any of these risk factors. What are the signs and symptoms? Delivery stalls after the head emerges and before the shoulders are out. This can occur unexpectedly in a labor that has progressed normally up to that point. What can you and your practitioner do? A variety of approaches may be used to deliver the baby whose shoulder is lodged in the pelvis, such as changing the mother's position by sharply pressing her thighs against her belly, applying pressure on her abdomen right above the pubic bone, or trying to turn the baby's shoulder while it's still inside. If the mom is mobile, for instance, hasn't had an epidural, rotating to an all-fours position might help. In some cases, such as when the estimated weight of the baby is over 9.9 pounds and the mom is diabetic, if the baby is estimated to weigh over 11 pounds in any pregnancy, or there was a shoulder dystocia in a prior pregnancy, the doctor might recommend a scheduled C-section to avoid the potential for vaginal delivery complications, including shoulder dystocia. Can it be prevented? Keeping your weight gain within the recommended range may lower the chances of having a baby too big to easily maneuver through the birth canal, as can carefully controlling diabetes or GD. Serious perineal tears. What is it? The pressure of your baby's large head pushing through the delicate tissues of your cervix and vagina can cause tears and lacerations in your perineum, the area between your vagina and your anus. First-degree tears when only the skin is torn, and second-degree tears when skin and vaginal muscle are torn, are common. But severe tears, those that get close to the rectum and involve the vaginal skin, tissues, and muscles of the anal sphincter, third degree, or those that actually cut into the rectum, fourth degree, cause pain and increase not only your postpartum recovery time, but your risk of incontinence, as well as other pelvic floor problems. Tears can also occur in the cervix. How common is it? Anyone having a vaginal delivery is at risk for a tear, and as many as half of moms will have at least a small tear. Third and fourth degree tears are much less common. What are the signs and symptoms? Bleeding is the immediate symptom. After the tear is repaired, you may also experience pain and tenderness at the site as it heals. What can you and your practitioner do? Generally, all lacerations that are longer than 2 centimeters, about 1 inch, or that continue to bleed are stitched. A local anesthetic may be given first if one wasn't given during delivery or if you didn't have an epidural. If you end up tearing or having an episiotomy, sitz baths, ice packs, witch hazel, anesthetic sprays, and simply exposing the area to air can help it heal more quickly and with less pain. Can it be prevented? Perineal massage and Kegel exercises during the month or so before your due date may help make your perineal area more supple and better able to stretch over your baby's head as he or she emerges, though perineal massage before labor will only be helpful if you're a first-timer. Warm compresses on the perineum and perineal massage during labor may help avoid tearing. Allowing the delivery to slow down and be controlled, pushing only when you feel the urge, not on a specific timetable, will give your perineum more time to stretch, so it'll be less likely to tear. Some practitioners suggest that delivering on all fours makes it less likely you'll tear, while squatting or lying flat on your back slightly increases the chances of tearing. Uterine rupture. What is it? A uterine rupture occurs when a weakened spot on your uterine wall, almost always the site of a previous uterine surgery, such as a C-section or fibroid removal, tears due to the strain put on it during labor and delivery. A uterine rupture can result in uncontrolled bleeding into your abdomen, or rarely lead to part of the placenta or baby entering your abdomen. How common is it? Fortunately, ruptures are rare in women who've never had a previous cesarean delivery or uterine surgery. Even women who labor after a previous C-section, have a VBAC, have only a 1 in 100 chance of rupture, and the risk is far lower when a woman undergoes a repeat section without labor. Women at greatest risk of uterine rupture are those attempting a VBAC who have been induced with prostaglandins, which is why VBACs are often not done if the mom needs to be induced. Abnormalities related to the placenta, such as placental abruption or placenta accreta, or to the baby's position, such as a fetus lying crosswise, can also increase the risk of uterine rupture. Uterine rupture is more common in women who have already had 6 or more babies or have a very distended uterus because of multiple fetuses or excess amniotic fluid. What are the signs and symptoms? Searing abdominal pain, a sensation that something is ripping, followed by diffuse pain and tenderness in the abdomen during labor, even in moms with epidurals, are the most common signs of uterine rupture. Most typically, the fetal monitor will show a significant drop in the baby's heart rate. The mother may develop signs of low blood volume, such as an increased heart rate, low blood pressure, dizziness, shortness of breath, or loss of consciousness. What can you and your practitioner do? If you have had a previous C-section or uterine surgery in which the uterine wall was cut through completely and you'd like to attempt a vaginal birth, discuss with your practitioner whether you're a good candidate for VBAC. Not being induced makes the extremely low risk of uterine rupture during VBAC even lower. If you do end up with a uterine rupture, an immediate C-section is necessary, followed by the repair of the uterus. You may also have to be given antibiotics to prevent infection. Can it be prevented? For women with increased risk, such as a previous C-section, fetal monitoring during labor can alert your practitioner to an impending or occurring rupture. Women who are trying for a VBAC delivery probably won't be induced, except in certain circumstances. Uterine inversion. What is it? Uterine inversion is a rare complication of childbirth that occurs when part of the uterine wall collapses and turns inside out, in effect like a sock being pulled inside out, sometimes even protruding through the cervix and into the vagina. In many cases, it is caused by the incomplete separation of the placenta from the uterine wall. The placenta then pulls the uterus with it when it emerges from the birth canal. Uterine inversion, when unnoticed and or untreated, can result in hemorrhage and shock. But that's a remote possibility, since the condition is unlikely to go unnoticed and untreated. How common is it? Uterine inversion is very rare. Rates vary from 1 in 2,000 births to 1 in 50,000. You are at greatest risk for uterine inversion if you've had an inversion during a previous delivery. Other factors that slightly increase the very remote risk include an extended labor lasting more than 24 hours, several previous vaginal deliveries, or use of drugs like magnesium sulfate given to halt preterm labor, which can over-relax the uterus. The uterus also may be more likely to invert if it's overly relaxed or if the umbilical cord is short and is pulled too hard during delivery. What are the signs and symptoms? Symptoms of uterine inversion include abdominal pain, excessive bleeding, signs of shock. In a complete inversion, the uterus will be visible in the vagina. What can you and your practitioner do? Know your risk factors and tell your practitioner if you've had a uterine inversion in the past. If you do have one, your practitioner will try to push your uterus back up and then give you Pitocin, oxytocin, to encourage any floppy muscles to contract. In rare cases where this does not work, surgery to reposition the uterus is an option. In either case, you might need a blood transfusion to make up for blood loss. Antibiotics may be given to prevent infection. Can it be prevented? Because a woman who's had an inversion is at an increased risk for another, Let your practitioner know if you've had one in the past. Postpartum hemorrhage. What is it? Bleeding after delivery, colochia, is normal, but sometimes the uterus doesn't contract as it should after birth, leading to postpartum hemorrhage, excessive or uncontrolled bleeding from the site where the placenta was attached, or from unrepaired vaginal or cervical lacerations. Hemorrhage can occur up to a week or two after delivery when fragments of the placenta are retained in or adhere to the uterus. Infection can also cause postpartum hemorrhage right after delivery or weeks later. How common is it? Postpartum hemorrhage occurs in 2 to 4% of deliveries. Excessive bleeding may be more likely to occur in these circumstances. The uterus is too relaxed and doesn't contract due to a long labor. The uterus is over-distended because of multiple births, a large baby, or excess amniotic fluid. There was a traumatic delivery. Bits of the placenta were retained, unnoticed by practitioner, after delivery. The placenta is oddly shaped or separates prematurely. Fibroids prevent symmetrical contraction of the uterus. The mother is very weak at the time of delivery due to anemia, preeclampsia, or extreme fatigue. She's been taking vitamin E, ibuprofen, or aspirin. She has an undiagnosed bleeding disorder. What are the signs and symptoms? The symptoms of postpartum hemorrhage include bleeding that soaks through more than one pad an hour for several hours, heavy, bright red bleeding for more than just a few days, passing very large clots, lemon size or larger, smaller clots are normal, pain or swelling, faintness, breathlessness, dizziness, a racing heart. The loss of large amounts of blood can make a woman feel faint, breathless, or dizzy, or cause her heart to speed up. What can you and your practitioner do? You should expect bleeding following delivery, but alert your practitioner immediately if you notice abnormally heavy bleeding or any of the previously listed symptoms during the first postpartum week. If the bleeding is severe enough to be categorized as a hemorrhage, you may need IV fluids or possibly even a blood transfusion. Can it be prevented? After the placenta is delivered, your practitioner will examine it to make certain that it's complete, that no part of it remained in your uterus, which could lead to excessive bleeding or infection. He or she will probably give you Pitocin, oxytocin, or other medications and may massage your uterus to encourage it to contract to minimize bleeding. Breastfeeding as soon as possible will also help your uterus contract, minimizing bleeding. Avoiding any supplement or medication that may interfere with blood clotting will also reduce the risk of excessive postpartum bleeding. Postpartum infection. What is it? The vast majority of new moms recover from delivery without any problems at all, but childbirth can occasionally leave you open to infection. That's because it can leave you with a variety of open wounds in your uterus where the placenta was attached, in your cervix, vagina, or perineum, especially if you tore or had an episiotomy, even if it was repaired, or at the site of a C-section incision. Postpartum infections can also occur in your bladder or kidney if you were catheterized. A fragment of the placenta inadvertently left behind in the uterus can lead to infection too. But the most common postpartum infection is endometritis, an infection of the lining of the uterus, the endometrium. While some infections can be dangerous, especially if they go undetected or untreated, most often infections simply make your postpartum recovery slower and more difficult, and they take time and energy away from your most important priority, getting to know your baby. For that reason alone, it's important to get help for any suspected infection as quickly as possible. How common is it? As many as 8% of deliveries result in an infection. Women who had a cesarean delivery or those who had premature rupture of the membranes are at greater risk. What are the signs and symptoms? Symptoms of postpartum infection vary depending on where the infection is, but there's almost always fever, pain or tenderness in the infected area, foul-smelling discharge from the vagina in the case of a uterine infection or from a wound, chills. What can you and your practitioner do? Call your practitioner if you're running a postpartum fever of 100 degrees for more than a day. Call right away if the fever is higher or if you notice any of the previously mentioned symptoms. If you have an infection, you'll probably receive a prescription for antibiotics, one that's breastfeeding friendly if you're nursing. Take it as prescribed for the entire course, even if you begin to feel better. Taking probiotics when you're on the course of antibiotics, though spaced at least 2 hours apart, may prevent associated diarrhea, vaginal yeast infection, or thrush in you or your baby if you're breastfeeding. You should also try to get plenty of rest and drink lots of fluids. Can it be prevented? Meticulous wound care and cleanliness after delivery can definitely help prevent infection. Wash your hands before touching the perineal area, wipe from front to back, and use only maxi pads, not tampons, for postpartum bleeding.
PPCM, peripartum cardiomyopathy. PPCM is a rare but serious weakening of heart muscle that happens during the last month of pregnancy or up to 5 months postpartum. Diagnosis is easy to miss because the symptoms, like ankle swelling and shortness of breath, can mimic third trimester symptoms, but other clues include swelling in the neck and racing heartbeat or palpitations. Medications can treat PPCM, and up to 50% of women will recover completely. All about if you're put on bed rest.
Bed rest, a still popular catch-all phrase for a pregnancy prescription that's increasingly known as activity restriction, can mean different things to different practitioners and to the patients they prescribe it for. Maybe it's just getting off your feet every couple of hours. Maybe it's that plus handing over the vacuum to your partner and turning in your gym membership for a while. Maybe it's staying in bed for at least half the day every day. And maybe it's a hospital stay for the last few weeks or months of your pregnancy. No matter what form it takes or what it's called, it's estimated that bed rest is still being prescribed in about 20% of pregnancies in the U.S. That number may be waning, but probably not as quickly as many practitioners, many pregnant patients, and even ACOG would like. So has this time-honored prescription for many problem pregnancies timed out? Probably not. There are still a number of reasons why a practitioner might recommend a restriction of activities, but probably the simplest rationale is that practitioners often have no other treatment options open when trying to prevent complications like preterm birth, and yet they feel compelled to do something. Certain moms-to-be are more likely to wind up on some kind of bed rest, including those who are over 35, because they're generally more at risk of pregnancy complications, as well as those who are carrying multiples, have a history of miscarriage due to cervical insufficiency, who have pregnancy bleeding, such as in a threatened miscarriage, have particular pregnancy complications such as preeclampsia, have certain chronic conditions, or have threatened preterm labor. What kind of rest? If you've been put on bed rest, it's likely you're marching, or in this case, no marching orders, came with a list of very specific can-dos and definitely don't-dos. That's because bed rest comes in a variety of packages. Here's the basic lowdown on each type of bed rest. Be sure to talk over the options with your practitioner if you're being put on any form of bed rest to make sure it's not stricter than it needs to be. Scheduled resting or activity restriction. In the hopes of preventing full bed rest later, some practitioners ask moms to be with certain risk factors, such as multiples or previous preterm delivery, to rest for a prescribed amount of time every day. The recommendation may be to sit with your feet up or lie down for 2 hours at the end of every workday, or rest for an hour lying down on your side, left preferably, but either side is fine, for every 4 hours that you're awake. Some practitioners may ask you to simply shorten your workday in your third trimester and restrict activities such as exercise, stair climbing, and walking or standing for extended lengths of time. Modified bed rest. With modified bed rest, you're generally prohibited from working in the office, though working from the comfort of home is probably okay. Driving and doing household chores. Now that's something to celebrate. Sitting up, possibly with your feet up, is probably fine, as is standing just long enough to make yourself a sandwich or take a shower. You may even be granted one outing per week, as long as it doesn't involve a long walk or any stairs. You'll also be able to go to your monthly or even weekly, if necessary, practitioner appointment. Moms-to-be on modified bed rest may split their day between the couch or recliner and the bed, but going up or downstairs will be kept to a minimum. Light physical therapy may be prescribed. Strict bed rest. This usually means you need to be horizontal all day, except for bathroom trips and a brief shower, using a shower chair if possible. If there are stairs in your house, you're going to have to pick a floor and stay there. Some women will be allowed to make a round trip between floors once a day. For others, it might be just once a week. Strict bed rest means no kitchen privileges, so unless you'll have someone around to serve up meals and snacks, you'll need a mini fridge or cooler by your bed. Light physical therapy may also be prescribed at home. Hospital bed rest. Some moms-to-be require constant monitoring, which means hospital admission. And just by the nature of being in the hospital, you'll be spending a lot more time in bed. However, given concerns about prolonged inactivity, if you're prescribed hospitalization, you may also be prescribed light physical therapy during your stay. A good thing, since it'll keep your muscles working in a way that's safe for you and your baby. If you've been admitted to the hospital because preterm labor has already begun, you'll likely need constant monitoring as well as IV meds. Your bed may even be positioned at a slight angle, feet higher than head, so that gravity can help keep your baby or babies growing in your womb for as long as possible. Pelvic rest. Yes, this means exactly what it sounds like, no sex. But what no sex means is up for interpretation, so be sure to ask exactly what it means in your circumstance. It might mean nothing inserted into the vagina, no penis, fingers, dildos, vibrators, and so on. It might mean no oral or anal sex either, or it might just mean no orgasm for you. You might be put on pelvic rest if you've been bleeding, such as with a threatened miscarriage in the first trimester, or later in pregnancy because of placenta previa, or because you have a history of preterm delivery, or if you're having premature contractions in this pregnancy, or because you have cervical insufficiency. Before you head to bed. Being sent to bed, check this list before you crawl under the covers. Check in with your health insurance company. Let your health plan know you've been put on bed rest and submit the right medical forms from your practitioner if necessary. Ask what home care, if any, will be covered. Ask, too, if you might be covered for physical therapy, medical supply rental, or even massage. You can also inquire about your coverage in case your baby is born prematurely. File for disability insurance. Bed rest can have enormous financial impact on a family that's about to expand. Another reason to be sure it's truly necessary as prescribed. If you won't be able to work, speak to someone in the HR department, if there is one, at your workplace to see if you qualify for short-term disability coverage. You should, though you and your practitioner will have to document the reasons why, and whether your bed rest time off from work will cut into your FMLA coverage, if you are entitled to any. Explore work-at-home options. If your job and your employer are flexible, you may be able to continue working at least part-time while on bed rest. Or, if your job doesn't allow this, perhaps you can look into opportunities that do. Load up your phone. Make sure you've updated your contact info with numbers you may need while you're stuck in bed. Your practitioner, the pharmacy, the hospital, neighbors and friends who can help you in a hurry. Create online or app accounts for restaurant delivery, grocery and drugstore delivery, online concierge services, dog walker services, laundry services, and so on, and let the deliveries begin, finances permitting. Hire help if possible, or enlist help from family, friends, and neighbors who've offered. You'll need a hand with light cleaning, errands, babysitting if you have other kids at home, carpooling if you have older kids who need to get to school, activities and play dates, meal prep, and laundry. If your friends and neighbors have offered to help, suggest they use online tools to keep things organized, such as lotsahelpinghands.com, carecalendar.org, or mealbaby.com. Give people who you'll want visiting access to your keys, or leave a key with a neighbor, the apartment manager, or doorman, so you don't have to get out of bed each time the doorbell rings. If possible, arrange to have a neighbor accept deliveries. Purchase or borrow a mini fridge that can be placed next to your bed or couch and stocked with drinks, cut-up veggies, cheese, yogurt, and other snacks that need to be chilled. Or consider a cooler lined with ice packs and restock daily. Set up a charging station for your laptop, phone, tablet, and anything else that'll need to be recharged. All the wires should be within easy reach. The downsides of resting. Staying off your feet, whether it's being sent to bed, your sofa, or the hospital for weeks or even months, definitely can take a physical toll. Prolonged inactivity can lead to hip and back pain, muscle loss, which can make it harder to bounce back once you deliver, skin irritation, aka bed sores, bone loss, and even blood clots in the legs. It may also aggravate many of the normal symptoms of pregnancy, such as heartburn, constipation, and leg swelling, as well as increase your risk for GD, since your body isn't breaking down glucose at its usual rate. Bed rest may decrease your appetite, which may keep you from eating enough to nourish your baby or babies. On the flip side, endless hours in bed can invite mindless eating, especially if you're out of your mind with boredom, and that can lead to excess weight gain, especially since you're not burning calories through regular activity and exercise. But there can be a psychological cost to bed rest too. Prolonged inactivity is linked to pregnancy depression and anxiety, especially if you're stuck indoors, cut off from activities that typically keep your mind and body busy, deprived of social interaction, exercise, and the natural high hormones it releases, sex, ditto. The stimulation of work, even exposure to sunlight, which boosts mood and regulates sleep. There's a loss, too, of the normal pregnancy experience, the one where everyone around you becomes extra attentive, solicitous, respectful, where that bump makes you feel extra special wherever you go. The emotional impact, like the physical impact, may linger after delivery and is associated with a higher risk of postpartum depression and anxiety disorders. Staying up when you're lying down. The thought of lying in bed or lounging around the house with the TV remote may sound pretty appealing until it's prescribed in the form of bed rest. Bed rest, unfortunately, is no pajama party. Once reality sets in, taking it easy can suddenly seem like hard work. That's why it's important not to lose sight of the big picture. Healthy pregnancy, healthy baby, and to remind yourself that your practitioner probably has good reason for keeping you off your feet, or at least off your regularly scheduled high-activity lifestyle. Once you find out from your practitioner exactly which activities are allowed and which aren't, use these tips to minimize some of the side effects. Physically, you may be surprised at the things you can still do when you're being asked to do less. A few suggestions. Move what you can. Your practitioner may allow, and in fact prescribe, some low-impact exercise, walks, light weights for your upper body, resistance bands for your lower body, to minimize muscle loss and maintain your strength. Stretch what you can. As much as you can under your practitioner's guidelines, stretch your legs, circle your ankles, and flex your feet to help prevent blood clots and keep your muscles strong. Raise and lower your arms, do shoulder rolls, do chest expansions, place your fingers behind your back and open your chest, and so on to keep up your strength in your upper body. And don't forget those Kegels, which you can do even if you're sent to bed. Monitor what you eat. A significant dip in a mom's appetite can lead to weight loss for her and a lower birth weight for her baby. So if you find you're slacking, fight back by grazing on nutritious snacks. Of course, if you find yourself eating too much out of boredom or depression, excessive weight gain might also become an issue. So keep an eye on nonstop nibbling and make sure you have healthy snacks handy. Stay hydrated. It's easy to remember to drink water when you're active, say after a run, but it's hard to work up a thirst in bed. Getting enough fluids helps minimize swelling and constipation, which are both compounded by moving less. Keep comfortable. If you're confined to bed for most or part of the day, maximize blood flow to your uterus by lying on your side, not your back, and change sides every hour or so to lessen body aches and prevent bed sores. Put a pillow under your head, a body pillow under your belly and between your knees, and perhaps a pillow behind you, a regular one or a specially designed one for propping, if that helps you to balance. Staying propped up in bed, especially after eating, also helps ease heartburn. Mentally, living with limitations on your activity can be hard to handle, especially if you're normally a very active person. Sometimes keeping yourself busy can provide a welcome distraction. Try to stay connected. Of course, you'll want to stay in touch with family and friends via phone, text messaging, video chatting, and social media, if only so you can vent to those who love you most. But you may find the most empathy and support from those who are also sitting out pregnancy, your fellow bed resters. You can find them on whattoexpect.com, and don't forget to go app happy with the What to Expect app. Structure the day. Try to establish a routine, even if the highlight is a short, approved walk down the block and a shower. Work from home. If your job allows it, go for it. But first, get clearance from your practitioner so you're clear what your limits are. For instance, how much stress you can be under. Prepare for baby. Register for your layette, order the gear, and scout for a doula, a lactation consultant, a pediatrician, even childcare options, all online. Create a baby playlist. Start playing the songs now, and your little one will likely be soothed by them later. Plus, music may soothe you when you need it the most, like now when you're feeling a little savage beast-like. Stream some shows. Two words, binge watch. Or catch up on reading, or listen to books on Audible. Get crafty. Knit, crochet, scrapbook, or quilt. If you don't know how, turn to YouTube or a crafty friend. You'll keep busy while creating keepsakes for your little one. Organize. Clean up your laptop and your phone once and for all. Catch up on software and app updates, and upload photos into a digital frame. Create a baby announcement list and design your e-card or paper birth announcement. Make sure you have all the addresses or email addresses ready to roll. You can even print out address labels in advance if you're pretty sure you won't want to handwrite them. Order stamps while you're at it. Socialize. Throw a pajama party. Order in pizza or have your friends bring over a potluck. And if you can't go out for your baby shower, ask your friends to throw it at your house or consider attending by video chat. Primp and polish. Try not to fall into the nobody's gonna see me anyway trap. Looking good makes you feel good, whether anyone sees you or not. So brush your hair, put on makeup, slather your tummy in yummy-smelling lotion. Your skin might be itchy and dry anyway. Treat yourself to a DIY facial or mani. If you can afford it, consider having a mobile hairstylist or manicurist make a house call. Drop the hint to your friends that this would make a great shower gift. Start a journal. Now's a great time to begin recording your thoughts in an online journal or in the What to Expect Pregnancy Journal and Organizer. Or consider writing a few letters to your baby to preserve pregnancy moments you can share with your child years later. Have some feelings about bed rest you'd like to vent? You can journal those too. Be a mommy-to-be blogger. Always wanted to write? Now's your chance. Keep your eyes on the prize. Frame one of your ultrasound pictures and keep it by your side or put it on your phone or tablet as your wallpaper. So whenever the going gets tough, you can remind yourself you have the best reason in the world not to go anywhere at all.
For dads, handling bed rest. Having her activity restricted is clearly no picnic for your partner, especially if she's actually banished to bed, and it's certainly no vacation for you either. In fact, you'll be working overtime trying to keep up with the household chores and errands that you may have previously shared, adding a variety of new job descriptions to your previously existing ones, from executive assistant to butler, chef and water bottle filler, chauffeur, housekeeper, pillow fluffer, amateur, or make that pop psychologist, and verbal punching bag, a girl's got a vent, all juggled with your regular job. Have other children at home? Their care and feeding will be your job too, for the most part. Her bed rest will be exhausting for you, for sure, but if you keep your eyes on the prize, a healthy mom and a healthy baby, you'll soldier through this rough patch. Here are some ways to help you and your partner handle the ups and downs of being put on bed rest. Set up a steady stream of visitors. Sure, she only has eyes for you, but after many long, boring days of staying home, or mostly home, your spouse may crave a change of pace and a change of faces. So work with your friends and family to put together a rotating schedule of visitors who will hang out with your honey. It'll be good for her, and you'll get the break you need and deserve. Bring on the entertainment. You'd be bored silly, or cranky, too, if you were stuck at home. Stock up on games, choose a TV series to download and binge-watch together, and learn the best takeout places in the neighborhood. Then order from them online. Surprise her with a mix of her favorite music. Exercise together. She might only be able to walk around the block, but with you by her side, that walk will be a lot more fun. She's been allowed to use light weights for some upper body moves. Grab your weights and do some chest flies while she does her light bicep curls. Encourage her to bicycle her legs, if that's allowed, or do foot flexes while you do some spinning on the stationary bike next to her. Do sit-ups in bed next to her while she's doing her neck rolls. Ask her in for a date. She may not be able to get out to a dinner and a movie, but you can bring the date night home or to the hospital room. Dress up, even if it's just your best PJs, put on some dinner music, bring out the candles and the nice dishes, and have her favorite restaurant deliver, or cook her favorite meal. It may not have the same ambiance she remembers from your nights out, but it'll be a welcome respite from the daily waiting game. Treat her. If it's in your price range or is covered by insurance, bring in a massage therapist for a prenatal rubdown. Just make sure it's cleared by her practitioner. See if a local nail salon will agree to a house call and, finances permitting, book her a mani-pedi. If that's out of your financial league or not up her alley, give her a back rub. Do facials together at home. Find an online recipe for one that's made from ingredients you probably have at home, like oatmeal or avocado. Or offer to paint the toes she can no longer reach. Talk her up. Just about every expectant mom could use an extra boost for her confidence. But mamas on bed rest can benefit from even more sweet-talking. Yes, you always think she's beautiful and sexy, even when she hasn't washed her hair in days or put on makeup in weeks. But does she know you think that? Let her know, as often as you can. Lend your shoulder and your ear. Sometimes she'll need to vent, and most times you'll be on the receiving end of her frustrations. For best results, and because she deserves it, respond with patience, understanding, and empathy. Talk her up, or talk her down when she's feeling on the ledge. Remind her she's beautiful, strong, and your own personal hero, and that this too shall pass, leaving you both with a cuddly prize package for her efforts. But also, let her unload as much as she needs to. As you attend to her emotional needs, however, try not to ignore your own entirely. Be sure to take a break yourself now and then. That's what the rotating schedule of visitors is for, and lean on your buddies for support, too. Being on bed rest is hard, but so is being the care provider for someone on bed rest. Watch her mood. Being stuck on bed rest is linked to an increased risk of pregnancy depression and anxiety disorder. Be alert to the signs, and if you notice them, take the steps necessary to get her the help she needs. Be alert, too, to the signs of postpartum depression, since pregnancy bed rest increases that risk as well. Is your mood worrying you? Depression can hit expectant and new dads, too. Check in with your doctor and make sure you get the help you need. Help her bounce back. Think that after all that rest, she'll be ready to run new baby marathons when it's over? Actually, the opposite will be true. The longer she has spent on restricted activity, the more deconditioned she'll become, and the less energy and stamina she'll have. Which means she'll actually be more tired than the average new mom, not more refreshed, and that she'll likely need more help during her postpartum recovery, not less. Give her that help, as well as the time she needs to get back her strength. But remember that both of you can expect to feel pretty drained for a while, thanks to your new parent positions.
Bed rest and the rest of your family. Wondering how bed rest will affect the rest of your family, from your partner to other children, including your furry ones? It will probably affect them in more ways than you'd imagine. Your partner. When you're sent to bed, your partner may be sent to work, overtime. Depending on your restrictions, he may become responsible for most of the household cleaning and laundry, errands, grocery shopping, and meal prep, all in addition to his regular job. Sex might be taken off the table too, so try to be gentle and patient with each other as you both power through this dry spell. And though you're probably aching for company after long days alone, encourage your partner to go out with friends occasionally. It'll do him good, and that will do you both good. Have other kids. He'll clearly have even more on his hands and in his arms and on his back and in his back seat. Since he's shouldering the load, try to be especially respectful of his parenting style and techniques, which might be different from yours. Your children. If you already have other children, especially age-appropriately clingy little ones who just want to be picked up and carted around on mom's hip, activity restriction can be an added challenge. You'll probably be looking at fewer tickle fests and hide-and-seek marathons and more tea parties, books, puzzles, coloring, and board games. You can also spend time together looking at pictures of your older child as a baby, helping him or her acclimate to the idea of the newborn soon to arrive. Try not to pin the blame for your bed rest on the baby-to-be, however, since that could set the stage for sibling rivalry. Instead, say the doctor's orders were to rest so that the baby can grow strong and healthy. If at all possible, have someone else take your toddler for a run around outside every day, since burning off some of that energy may facilitate quieter playtime with you. Feeling guilty about not being there for your older ones? That's understandable. Guilt sort of comes with the mom territory. But try to let it go. Remember, your little ones cherish every mama moment, even those spent snuggling in bed together. Your pets. For some dogs and most cats, it doesn't get better than lying in bed or on the sofa with mommy all day. But for the frisky few who need interactive playtime, mom's activity restriction can cramp their style. Ditto those who need long walks. Of course, your partner can take over the pet care, and if necessary, you can try to find a dog walker. But if your fur baby is extra mommy dependent, you'll also have to do some extra reassuring and petting.
Moms helping moms. Every pregnancy comes with some challenges, but a pregnancy that's high risk or one that's been complicated can come with a whole lot more. Facing those challenges is always easier when you've got company, other moms who know exactly what you're going through because they're going through it too, or have already gone through it themselves. You're likely to find that support online. Check out whattoexpect.com, sidelines.org, betterbedrest.org, and keepemcooking.com.
When the rest is over. It might seem counterintuitive, but the more you rest, the more tired you can become, and that's definitely true when you've been put on bed rest for any length of time. Even the littlest efforts can seem monumental when you've lost muscle tone and strength, and when decreased aerobic capacity can leave you out of breath just climbing a few stairs. Add labor delivery and recovery to that debilitating equation, along with normal new parent sleep deprivation, and you can expect to drag physically even more than the average mom, who's plenty tired herself. So keep your expectations realistic after delivery. Cut yourself some postpartum slack, factoring in all your body has been through and what it's still going through now. Plan on building back up to your former fitness level slowly but surely. Start off gradually, modifying the recommended postpartum exercises, even if those are difficult, and then building up as your stamina and muscle mass increases. Walking, yoga, and swimming are good activities to get back into the game. With consistent effort on your part and help from your practitioner, family, and friends, don't worry, you'll get there.
Chapter 20, Pregnancy Loss.
Pregnancy is supposed to be the happiest of times, filled with excitement, anticipation, and pink and blue daydreams about life with your baby-to-be. And usually, it is all of those things, but not always. Sometimes a pregnancy ends unexpectedly and tragically. Even if you only saw your baby on ultrasound, you bonded with your son or daughter each day he or she was growing inside of you. And having those dreams and hopes of a future shattered is understandably heartbreaking. If you've experienced the loss of a pregnancy, or if you've had a stillborn baby, you know firsthand that the depth of your pain can be beyond words. This chapter is dedicated to helping you and your partner understand what happened, handle the pain, and cope with one of life's most difficult losses.
Types of pregnancy loss.
Early miscarriage. What is it? A miscarriage is a loss of an embryo or fetus before it is able to live outside the uterus, resulting in the unplanned end of a pregnancy. When such a loss happens in the first trimester, as it does 80% of the time, it's called an early miscarriage. A miscarriage that occurs between the end of the first trimester and week 20 is considered a late miscarriage. An early pregnancy loss is often related to a chromosomal or other genetic defect in the embryo, but it can also be caused by hormonal and other factors. Most often, the cause can't be identified. Miscarriage is not caused by exercise, sex, working hard, lifting heavy objects, a sudden scare, emotional stress, a fall, or a minor blow to the abdomen, and it isn't triggered by even the most severe morning sickness. How common is it? Early miscarriage is far more common than most women realize. Though it's hard to know for sure, researchers have estimated that over 40% of conceptions end in miscarriages. But since well over half of miscarriages occurs so early that a woman doesn't even know she's pregnant yet, they often go unnoticed, passing for a normal or sometimes heavier period.
You'll want to know. Happily, the vast majority of women who experience a miscarriage go on to have a perfectly normal and healthy pregnancy in the future.
Signs and symptoms. The symptoms of a miscarriage can include some or all of the following. Cramping or pain, sometimes severe, in the center of the lower abdomen or back. Heavy vaginal bleeding, possibly with clots and or tissue, similar to a period. Light staining, continuing for more than 3 days. A sudden pronounced decrease in or loss of the usual signs of early pregnancy, such as breast tenderness and nausea, not the normal gradual diminishing as the first trimester comes to a close. A cervix that appears open, dilated, when examined by the practitioner. No embryo visible on ultrasound. The sac is empty. No heartbeat detected on ultrasound.
Are you spotting? Seeing red or pink or brown on your panties or toilet paper is definitely scary when you're expecting, but not all spotting or bleeding means you're miscarrying or losing your baby. Some women spot on and off for their entire pregnancies. Sometimes spotting, heavy bleeding, and or cramping indicate a threatened miscarriage. That, too, doesn't mean you're definitely losing your baby. If you're not sure when to call your practitioner for spotting or bleeding, listen to our tips in the chapter on managing complications.
What can you and your practitioner do? If your practitioner finds that your cervix is dilated and or no fetal heartbeat is detected on ultrasound and your dates are correct, it means that you are having a miscarriage or have already had one. Sadly, nothing can be done to prevent the loss at this stage. If you're in a lot of pain from the cramping, your practitioner may recommend or prescribe a pain reliever. Don't hesitate to ask for relief from the pain if you need it. Many miscarriages are complete, meaning all the contents of the uterus are expelled from the vagina. That's why there's often so much bleeding. But sometimes, especially the later in the first trimester you are, a miscarriage isn't complete and parts of the pregnancy remain in the uterus. This is known as an incomplete miscarriage. Or a heartbeat isn't detected on ultrasound, which means the embryo or fetus has died, but no bleeding has occurred yet. This is called a missed miscarriage. In either of these cases, your uterus will eventually be or need to be emptied so that you can recover and your normal menstrual cycle can resume, and you can try to get pregnant again if you choose to. There are several ways that this can happen. Expectant management. You and your practitioner may choose to let nature take its course and wait until the pregnancy is naturally expelled. Waiting out a missed or incomplete miscarriage can take anywhere from a few days to, in some cases, 3 to 4 weeks. Medication. Medication, usually a misoprostol pill taken orally or vaginally as a suppository, can prompt your body to expel the fetal tissue and placenta and can be used in a missed or incomplete miscarriage, as well as a blighted ovum, a fertilized egg that implants but doesn't develop. Just how long this takes varies, but typically it's only a matter of days at the most before the miscarriage is completely expelled, though bleeding can continue for a few days longer. Side effects of the medication can include nausea, vomiting, cramping, and diarrhea. Surgery. Another option is to undergo a minor surgical procedure called dilation and vacuum curettage, DNC. During this procedure, the doctor gently dilates your cervix and removes, by suction, the fetal tissue and placenta from your uterus. Bleeding following the procedure usually lasts no more than a week. Though side effects are rare, there is a slight risk of infection following a DNC. How should you and your practitioner decide which route to take? Some factors you both can take into account include how far along the miscarriage is. If bleeding and cramping are already heavy, the miscarriage is probably already well underway. In that case, allowing it to progress naturally may be preferable to a DNC. But if there's no bleeding yet, as in a missed miscarriage, misoprostol or a DNC might be better alternatives. How far along the pregnancy is. The farther along the pregnancy is, the more fetal tissue there will be, and the more likely a DNC will be necessary to empty your uterus completely. Your emotional and physical state. Waiting for a natural miscarriage to occur after an embryo or fetus has died in utero can be psychologically debilitating. It's likely that you won't be able to begin coming to terms with and grieving for your loss while the pregnancy is still inside of you. Completing the process faster will also allow you to resume your menstrual cycle soon, and when and if the time is right, to conceive again. Risks and benefits. Because a DNC is invasive, it carries a slightly higher, though still very low, risk of infection. The benefit of having the miscarriage complete sooner, however, may greatly outweigh that small risk for some women. With a naturally occurring miscarriage, there's also the risk that it won't completely empty the uterus, in which case a DNC may be necessary to finish what nature has started. Evaluation of the miscarriage. When a DNC is performed, evaluating the cause of the miscarriage through an examination of the fetal tissue will be easier. If this isn't your first miscarriage, genetic testing can be performed on the tissue as well, which can help predict the likelihood of a recurrence, as well as provide some measure of closure. If you miscarry naturally and feel able physically and emotionally, and both might be extremely difficult, to save the expelled pregnancy, you can do this in a sterile cup or small storage container so that it can be tested later. No matter what course is taken, and whether the ordeal is over sooner or later, the loss will likely be difficult for you.
Types of early miscarriage. If you're experiencing an early pregnancy loss, the sadness you're feeling is the same no matter the cause or the official medical name. Still, it's helpful to know about the different types of miscarriage so you're familiar with the terms your practitioner might be using. Chemical pregnancy. A chemical pregnancy occurs when an egg is fertilized but fails to develop successfully or implant fully in the uterus. A woman may miss her period and suspect she's pregnant. She may even have a positive pregnancy test because her body has produced some low but detectable levels of the pregnancy hormone HCG. But in a chemical pregnancy, there will be no gestational sac or placenta, and the pregnancy ends in what seems like a period. Experts estimate that up to 70% of all conceptions are chemical, and many women who experience one don't even realize they've conceived. Often, a very early positive pregnancy test and then a late period, a few days to a week late, are the only signs of a chemical pregnancy. Blighted ovum. A blighted ovum, or anembryotic pregnancy, refers to a fertilized egg that attaches to the wall of the uterus and begins to develop a placenta, which produces HCG, but then fails to develop into an embryo. What is left behind is an empty gestational sac, which can be seen on an ultrasound. Experts believe that up to half of all early miscarriages are blighted ovums. Most blighted ovum miscarriages occur very early in the first trimester. Some even occur before a woman realizes she's conceived and end in what seems like a late period. Others are only noticed during a routine early ultrasound when, after weeks 5 or 6, a gestational sac is visible, but there is no embryo inside it. Missed miscarriage. A missed miscarriage is when the embryo or fetus dies but isn't expelled, at least not right away. Often there are no signs initially, no bleeding, for instance, and in some cases, the placenta continues to produce hormones, which makes your body think you're still pregnant. A missed miscarriage is usually discovered during a routine first trimester ultrasound when there is no heartbeat detected, or later on, in the first trimester, when the heartbeat can't be heard with Doppler. The fact that there are no warning signs, you come to your appointment expecting to see or hear the heartbeat and there isn't one, can make the realization all the more painful. Some women notice the loss of all existing pregnancy symptoms, though that in and of itself doesn't mean that the pregnancy is lost, and less commonly experience a brownish discharge. Complete miscarriage. A complete miscarriage is when all the pregnancy tissue, embryo, and placenta passes from the uterus through the vagina. The woman experiences bleeding and cramping, and the miscarriage completely empties the uterus without any medical intervention. On examination, the practitioner finds that the cervix has reclosed and there is no sign of a pregnancy sac in the uterus on ultrasound. The earlier the miscarriage occurs, usually those earlier than 12 weeks, the more likely it is to be a complete one. Incomplete miscarriage. An incomplete miscarriage is when the embryo or fetus is no longer viable and passes through the vagina via bleeding along with some of the tissue from the placenta. But some pregnancy tissue stays inside the uterus. With an incomplete miscarriage, a woman continues to cramp and bleed, sometimes heavily, and her cervix remains dilated. Because there is some remaining placental tissue in the uterus, it continues to produce HCG, which is detectable in blood tests and doesn't fall as expected. The remaining tissue in the uterus is also still visible on an ultrasound. Age and miscarriage. More and more older moms are getting pregnant and having healthy babies at the time in their lives that's right for them and their partners, who are often older too. But on average, with increasing age comes an increased risk of miscarriage. That's because the older eggs of older moms, and possibly their older partner's sperm, are more likely to contain a genetic defect that results in an embryo that isn't viable, that is, one that can't survive. These embryos are most often miscarried. So while a 20-year-old's odds of losing a pregnancy are 10 to 15%, a 35-year-old has a 20% chance of miscarrying. A 40-year-old has a 40% chance, and a 45-year-old's risk of pregnancy loss is over 80%. When a woman conceives through advanced reproductive techniques like IVF, which women over 40 are more likely to do, the risks of miscarriage can be lowered, though not eliminated, through pre-implantation screening, which stacks the odds of a healthy pregnancy by implanting only those embryos that appear healthy and viable.
Molar pregnancy. What is it? A molar pregnancy starts when an egg is fertilized, but instead of a normal pregnancy resulting, the placenta develops into an abnormal mass of cysts, also known as a hydatidiform mole, and there is no accompanying fetus, in some cases identifiable but not viable embryonic or fetal tissue is present. This is called a partial molar pregnancy. The cause of a molar pregnancy is an abnormality during fertilization, in which two sets of chromosomes from the father become mixed in with either one set of chromosomes from the mother, partial mole, or none of her chromosomes at all, complete mole. Most molar pregnancies are discovered within weeks of conception. How common is it? Molar pregnancies are relatively rare, occurring in only 1 out of 1,000 pregnancies. Women under the age of 20 or over the age of 35, as well as women who have had multiple miscarriages, are at slightly increased risk for a molar pregnancy. What are the signs and symptoms? A molar pregnancy seems like a normal pregnancy in the beginning. But then the expectant mother may notice dark brown to bright red vaginal bleeding during the first trimester, severe nausea and vomiting, sometimes uncomfortable cramping. The practitioner may notice other signs, including high blood pressure, a uterus that is larger than expected, a uterus that is doughy rather than firm, an absence of embryonic or fetal tissue, presence of tissue that isn't viable, as seen on ultrasound, or lack of a fetal heartbeat. If an ultrasound shows that you do have a molar pregnancy, the abnormal tissue must be removed via a D&C. Remember, even if there's embryonic or fetal tissue, it's not viable. That is, it can't develop into a baby. Follow-up is crucial to make sure it doesn't develop into a malignancy, like choriocarcinoma. Though luckily, the chances of this happening in a treated molar pregnancy are very low.
Choriocarcinoma. Choriocarcinoma is an extremely rare pregnancy-related cancer occurring in only 1 out of every 40,000 pregnancies that grows from the cells of the placenta. This malignancy most often occurs after a molar pregnancy, miscarriage, abortion, or ectopic pregnancy, when any left-behind placental tissues continue to grow despite the absence of a fetus. Only 15% of choriocarcinomas occur after a normal pregnancy. The condition is usually diagnosed when there has been intermittent bleeding following a miscarriage, a pregnancy, or the removal of a molar pregnancy, as well as abnormal tissue discharge, elevated HCG levels that do not return to normal after a pregnancy has ended, a tumor in the vagina, uterus, or lungs, and/or abdominal pain. If you are diagnosed, the news is very reassuring. While any type of cancer carries with it some risk, choriocarcinoma responds extremely well to chemotherapy and radiation treatments and has a cure rate of more than 90%. Hysterectomy is almost never necessary because of this type of tumor's excellent response to chemotherapy drugs. And happily, with early diagnosis and treatment of choriocarcinoma, fertility is unaffected. Though it's usually recommended that trying for another pregnancy be postponed for 1 year after treatment for choriocarcinoma is complete and there is no remaining evidence of disease. You'll want to know. Having had a molar pregnancy doesn't put you at much higher risk for having another one. In fact, only 1 to 2% of women who have had a molar pregnancy go on to experience a second.
Ectopic pregnancy. What is it? An ectopic pregnancy, also known as a tubal pregnancy, is a non-viable pregnancy that implants outside the uterus, most commonly in a fallopian tube, usually because something such as scarring in the fallopian tube obstructs or slows the movement of the fertilized egg into the uterus. An ectopic pregnancy can also occur in the cervix, on the ovary, or in the abdomen. Unfortunately, there is no way for an ectopic pregnancy to continue normally. Ultrasound can detect an ectopic pregnancy, often as early as 5 weeks. But without early diagnosis and treatment of an ectopic pregnancy, the fertilized egg might continue to grow in the fallopian tube, leading to a rupture of the tube. If the tube bursts, its ability in the future to carry a fertilized egg to the uterus is destroyed. And if the rupture is not cared for, it can result in severe, even life-threatening internal bleeding and shock for the mother. Luckily, quick treatment, usually surgery or medication, can help avoid such a rupture and removes most of the risks for the mother while greatly improving the chances of preserving her fertility. How common is it? About 2% of all pregnancies are ectopic. Women at risk of having an ectopic pregnancy include those with a history of endometriosis, pelvic inflammatory disease, a prior ectopic pregnancy or tubal surgery, and women who smoke, have an STD, or conceived while using progesterone-only birth control pills. An IUD doesn't increase the risk of an ectopic pregnancy, but when pregnancies occur with an IUD, they are more commonly ectopic. What are the signs and symptoms? Like many miscarriages, abnormal bleeding is an early sign. But with an ectopic pregnancy, there will be sharp, crampy pain with tenderness, usually in the lower abdomen. It often begins as a dull ache that progresses to spasms and cramps as well. Pain may worsen on straining of bowels, coughing, or moving. If the fallopian tube ruptures, there will be heavy bleeding inside the abdomen, and you may experience severe, sharp abdominal pain. Rectal pressure, shoulder pain due to blood accumulating under the diaphragm, heavier vaginal bleeding, lightheadedness, fainting, and shock. What can you and your practitioner do? If it is determined that you have an ectopic pregnancy, usually diagnosed through ultrasound and blood tests, there is, unfortunately, no way to save the pregnancy. You'll most likely have to undergo surgery via laparoscopy to remove the tubal pregnancy or be given drugs, methotrexate, which will end the abnormally occurring pregnancy. In some rare cases, it can be determined that the ectopic pregnancy is no longer developing and can be expected to disappear over time on its own, which would also eliminate the need for surgery. Because residual material from a pregnancy left in the tube could damage it, a follow-up test of the HCG levels is performed to be sure the entire tubal pregnancy was removed or has been reabsorbed.
You'll want to know. More than half of the women who are treated for ectopic pregnancies conceive and have a normal pregnancy within a year. If you've had an early pregnancy loss, though it can be hard for parents to accept it at the time, when an early pregnancy loss occurs, it's usually because the condition of the embryo or fetus wasn't compatible with life. Early miscarriage is generally a natural selection process in which an abnormal embryo or fetus, defective because of genetic abnormality, poor implantation in the uterus, maternal infection, random accident, or other unknown reasons, is lost because it is incapable of survival. That said, losing a baby, even at the earliest stages of life, even when the loss was inevitable from the start, can be traumatic. So allow yourself to grieve as much as you need to. It's a necessary part of the healing process. But also remember that there's no one way you should feel, since everyone experiences this kind of grief differently. You may feel far sadder than you might have expected to,
Or you may feel ready to move on far sooner than you thought you might, or you may feel all over the map emotionally. Grieve and heal your way, in your own time. Sharing your feelings with your partner will be essential, and finding support from others, especially those who have also experienced a pregnancy loss, may be enormously helpful too. But again, do what feels right for you. Just try not to let guilt compound your pain. Miscarriage is not your fault.
Late miscarriage. What is it? The loss of a baby between the end of the first trimester and the 20th week is called a late miscarriage, though the medical term is miscarriage, and though the baby is still considered pre-viable, unable to live outside the womb, the loss can feel more palpable because the pregnancy felt more palpable, especially if you've watched your belly swell, felt the first kicks, and wondered at those beautiful little features developing before your eyes on ultrasound. You'll find help coping with this kind of devastating loss later in the chapter. How common is it? Late miscarriages occur in about 6 in 1,000 pregnancies. A late miscarriage is usually related to the mother's health. A chronic condition such as an antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, or rarely poorly controlled diabetes, the condition of her uterus, cervical insufficiency, an untreated bacterial infection, or problems of the placenta. Sometimes a late miscarriage is due to chromosomal or other genetic abnormalities in the fetus. What are the signs and symptoms? The signs and symptoms of a late miscarriage include heavy bleeding, possibly including blood clots, accompanied by strong cramping and abdominal pain. A dilated cervix found during examination. No fetal heartbeat detected on ultrasound or with Doppler. A complete cessation of baby's movements, if the mother has already begun feeling movement consistently. What can you and your practitioner do? If you're experiencing the type of heavy bleeding and painful cramping that signal a miscarriage, there's usually nothing, unfortunately, that can be done to stop the inevitable. The miscarriage may be complete, or your practitioner may need to perform a D&C to remove any remnants of the pregnancy. If the miscarriage hasn't begun on its own, yet it's clear during a routine office visit or ultrasound that there is no fetal heartbeat, your practitioner may bring you into the hospital to induce labor using misoprostol, or for a procedure similar to a D&C called a D&E, dilation and evacuation, in which surgical methods are used to deliver the fetus and placenta. A D&E is considered safer than induction because of decreased risk of infection and bleeding, but talk to your practitioner about the relative risks and benefits of both options. If induction is chosen, depending on how far along in the pregnancy you are, you may have the opportunity to hold your baby, and doing so may help in the grieving process. A late miscarriage will be emotionally painful, and it is also likely to be physically painful, so be sure to ask for medication if you need it.
You'll want to know. When the cause of a late miscarriage can be determined, it may be possible to prevent a repeat of the tragedy. If a previously undiagnosed cervical insufficiency, an incompetent cervix, was responsible, future miscarriages can be prevented by cerclage early in pregnancy, before the cervix begins to dilate. If chronic disease, such as diabetes, hypertension, or obesity is responsible, the condition can be brought under control prior to any future pregnancy. An abnormally shaped uterus, or one that is distorted by the growth of fibroids, polyps, or a septum, a piece of tissue that divides all or part of the uterine cavity in two, in some instances can be corrected by surgery. The presence of antibodies that trigger placental inflammation and/or clotting may be treated with low-dose aspirin and heparin injections in a subsequent pregnancy. Some causes of late miscarriage, such as acute infection, are very unlikely to recur.
Lactation suppression when a baby dies. When you've suffered the loss of a baby, the last thing you need is another reminder of what would have been. Sadly, nature can deliver that reminder when the end of pregnancy, even when it has ended tragically, automatically signals the beginning of lactation, and your breasts fill with the milk that was intended to feed your baby. That will be emotionally painful, of course, but breast engorgement will also make it physically painful. Ice packs, mild pain relievers, and a supportive bra can help minimize the physical discomfort you'll feel. Avoiding hot showers, nipple stimulation, and expressing milk from your breasts will help stop further milk production. The engorgement will pass within a few days. Stillbirth. What is it? The loss of the baby in utero any time after the 20th week is called a stillbirth. Most stillbirths occur before labor begins, though a small number of stillbirths occur during labor and delivery. After so many months of becoming attached to your baby, preparing for your baby, and feeling and seeing your baby's kicks, the pain of a stillbirth is profoundly heartbreaking. How common is it? Stillbirth occurs in about 1 in 160 pregnancies. The reasons babies die in utero range from birth defects, about 15% of stillborn babies have one or more birth defects, to poor fetal growth, which accounts for about 35% of stillborn babies, placental problems like placental abruption, which account for about 20% of stillbirths, knots in the umbilical cord, 2%, chronic health conditions in the mother like diabetes, hypertension, or obesity, about 10%, and maternal or fetal infections, around 10% of the time. Severe trauma, for instance from a serious car accident or lack of oxygen during a difficult delivery, can also be the cause of a stillbirth. What are the signs and symptoms? The pregnant woman may suspect something is wrong if fetal movement suddenly stops. An ultrasound will confirm that there is no fetal heartbeat. During labor, the lack of a heartbeat could be detected by the fetal monitor or Doppler. What can you and your practitioner do? Even if your baby's movements have stopped, leading you to fear the worst, there is no way to prepare for the news that your baby has died in your uterus. You are likely to be in a fog of disbelief and grief after being told your baby's heartbeat can't be located. It may be difficult or even impossible for you to carry on with any semblance of your usual life while carrying around a baby who is no longer living. And studies show that a mother is much more likely to suffer severe depression after the delivery of a stillborn if the delivery is delayed more than 3 days after the death is diagnosed. For this reason, your emotional state will be taken into account while your practitioner decides what to do next. If labor is imminent or has already started, your stillborn baby will be delivered. If labor isn't clearly about to start, the decision of whether to induce labor immediately or to allow you to return home until it begins spontaneously will depend on how far you are from your due date, your physical condition, and how you're doing emotionally. Most practitioners recommend inducing labor within 1 to 2 days. After delivery, the fetus, placenta, and umbilical cord are examined carefully to help determine why the baby died. ACOG recommends that genetic testing be performed in all stillbirths with parental permission. Also with parental permission, an autopsy may be performed. Your practitioner may also suggest some testing for you, but in up to half of all cases, testing can't ultimately determine the cause of stillbirth.
All about coping with pregnancy loss.
No matter how or when you lose a pregnancy, it can hurt deeply. Everyone deals with a pregnancy loss differently, but here are some ways of coping. Coping with first trimester loss. Just because it often takes place very early in pregnancy doesn't mean that miscarriage can't be painful for expectant parents. Even though you never saw your baby, except perhaps on ultrasound, you knew that a new life was growing inside of you, and you may have already formed a bond, however abstract. Then, just as it was beginning, that life abruptly ends, and the promise of the months and years ahead is broken. Understandably, you'll be sad, but you may also experience other, less expected emotions. You may be angry at your body for letting you down, or resentful of friends and family who are pregnant or have babies. You may have trouble eating or sleeping or even accepting the loss. You may cry a lot or not at all. These are among the many natural, healthy responses to a pregnancy loss. Remember, your reaction is what's normal for you. Some couples approach an early loss matter-of-factly, easily accepting that this pregnancy wasn't meant to be, ready to move on and eager to try again. Others find it much harder, and in some cases, coping with the early loss ends up being, in certain ways, as difficult as coping with a loss later on. One reason why, because so many couples hold off on spreading the word about their pregnancy until the first trimester has passed, even close friends and family may not have been told yet, which can mean that support may be hard to come by. Even those who knew about the pregnancy and or told about the miscarriage may offer less support than they would have if the pregnancy had been further along. They may try to minimize the significance of the loss with a, "Don't worry, you can try again," or, "You're lucky it happened so early," not realizing that the loss of a baby, no matter how early in pregnancy it occurs, can be devastating. Still, if you've suffered a miscarriage or an ectopic or molar pregnancy, remember that you have the right to grieve as much or as little as you need to. Do this in any way that helps you heal and eventually move on, in your way and in your time. Saying goodbye, which for many parents is a vital step in the recovery process, is in some ways harder when there's nothing tangible left to say goodbye to. Perhaps you'll find closure in a private ceremony with close family members, or just you and your spouse, or by sharing your feelings, individually, through a support group, or online, with others who have experienced early miscarriage. Since so many women suffer a miscarriage at least once during their reproductive years, you may be surprised to find how many others you know have had the same experience as you but never talked about it to you, or maybe even talked about it at all. If you don't feel like sharing your feelings or don't feel you need to, don't. Do only what's right for you. Some of the tips for those who have later pregnancy losses may be helpful for you too. Accept that you may always have a place in your heart for the pregnancy you lost, and you may feel sad on the anniversary of the due date of your lost baby, or on the anniversary of the miscarriage itself, even years later. If you find it helps, plan on doing something special at that time to commemorate, planting some new flowers or tree, having a quiet picnic in the park. While it's normal to mourn your loss and important to come to terms with it your way, you should also start to gradually feel better as time passes. For many women, it could take 6 months before feeling better. For others, it could take up to 2 years. If you don't, or if you have continued trouble coping with everyday life, you're not eating or sleeping, you're not able to focus at work, you're becoming isolated from family and friends, or if you continue to feel very anxious, anxiety is an even more common symptom after miscarriage than depression is. Professional counseling and possibly other therapies can help you recover. Try to remind yourself that you can and most likely will become pregnant again and give birth to a healthy baby if that's what you decide you want. For the vast majority of women, a miscarriage is a one-time event and actually an indication of future fertility.
A personal process. When it comes to dealing with a miscarriage or other pregnancy loss, there's no single emotional formula that must be followed. Different couples confront, cope with, and process their feelings in completely different ways. You may find yourself deeply saddened, even devastated by the loss, and discover that healing comes surprisingly slowly. Or you may handle the loss more matter-of-factly, seeing it as a bump in the road to having a baby. You may find that after some momentary sadness, you're able to put the experience behind you more quickly than you might have expected, and instead of lingering over the loss, you may choose to look ahead to trying again. There are a number of factors that may contribute to your sense of loss. How long it took you to conceive. Often the longer it took, the more painful the loss may feel. If you conceived with the help of assisted reproduction, sometimes the more advanced the technology used to become pregnant, the greater the emotional investment in the pregnancy and the greater the loss may feel. Your age, if you feel the pressure of your biological clock, you may also feel the loss more intensely as you worry if time will run out. The length of the pregnancy. The longer you were pregnant, the more time you had to connect to your baby. And how many losses you've had. Grief often builds with each loss, or may contribute to a sense of hopelessness or even numbness. Dads may grieve as much, but in a different way. Just remember, the normal reaction to a pregnancy loss is the reaction that's normal for you. Allow yourself to feel whatever you need to feel in order to heal. Postpartum depression and pregnancy loss. Every parent who loses a baby has reason to feel sad, but for some, the sadness can be deepened by postpartum depression and/or anxiety, triggered in part by the same inevitable, precipitous drops in pregnancy hormones, acutely heightened by the abrupt end of the pregnancy and tragic loss of the baby. Untreated, PPD can prevent you from experiencing the stages of grief that are essential to healing, though it might be hard to distinguish PPD from the depression brought on by the loss of your baby. Any kind of depression requires help. If you're exhibiting signs of depression, loss of interest in everyday activities, inability to sleep, loss of appetite, extreme sadness that interferes with your ability to function, don't hesitate to get the help you need. Speak to your prenatal practitioner or your regular doctor and ask to be referred to a mental health professional. Therapy and, if necessary, medication can help you feel better.
Coping with second trimester loss. The word miscarriage is nearly always associated with pain and sadness. After all, the loss of a baby at any time is something to grieve over. But it's also nearly always associated with the early weeks of pregnancy, a time when the new life growing deep within feels especially vulnerable, abstract, far from palpable. A time when couples often stay guarded in their joy for fear of loving and losing that new life. Are you ever prepared for a miscarriage? No, but it's something you're more likely to expect, if not accept, when it takes place in the first trimester. And that's why a second trimester loss can hit so hard. By then, you're off your guard, beginning to see and possibly feel tangible proof of the life within. What was once a blob of cells, then a tiny tadpole, has miraculously transformed into a baby. And if you didn't dare to dream about that baby's future before, those dreams have almost certainly started by the second trimester. Everything is normal. Everything is as it should be. You can breathe easily. Then, suddenly, it isn't normal. Something is terribly wrong. The pain and the shock may take your breath away, leaving you wondering whether you'll ever breathe easily again, and leaving you asking, of course, why? If something was so wrong, why didn't this loss happen when you were in your first trimester, when you were at least prepared for the possibility? Why did it happen after you'd spent so many weeks and months bonding with your baby and your blossoming baby bump, and maybe even feeling those flutters of life? Why did it have to happen at all? And as if the news that you lost your baby isn't heartbreaking enough, you may also have to go to the hospital to endure labor and delivery. Going through the motions of delivering a baby you won't be going home with is, understandably, a terrible burden to bear. As is being, most likely, in a wing of the hospital devoted to delivering joy, where happy parents welcome healthy babies, celebrating the beginning of a lifetime, while you're faced with a tragic ending. What's more, when you return home with your arms empty and your heart broken, you'll have the physical recovery to cope with in addition to the emotional healing. This can be true even if you didn't have to go through labor but had a D&C or D&E instead. If the option of holding and seeing your baby is possible, consider it carefully. While it may feel unnatural to hold the tiny baby you've just lost, it will likely give you comfort later when you're able to look back at your loss and remember the brief time you had together. It may also help make the loss more real, and though that painful reality may be exactly what you'd like to avoid facing, It will help you begin the grieving process that's a necessary part of healing. Consider, too, making a keepsake folder or memory box with your baby's footprint, handprint, lock of hair, and pictures if these are options for you. Use your baby's name when you talk about him or her, and if you hadn't chosen a name before, consider naming your baby now. And be sure to talk to the doctors, nurses, and grief counselors about your options for burying or cremating your baby if you'd like to do so. But remember, as always, what's right for you and your partner during this devastating time is what's right. Don't feel obligated to follow a formula that anyone else suggests. Just how much pain will you experience and for how long? There is no time limit on grief, no minimum or maximum. Everyone is different, and you'll need to heal in your own way at your own pace. Use whatever is necessary to find solace, a retreat with your partner, talking online with other women who've also experienced similar loss, a memorial service for a baby, joining a support group, reaching out to a grief counselor, or trying to get pregnant again soon, if that's an option. Comfort might come quickly, or it might take a long time. Either way, it's completely normal. Finally, remember and keep reminding yourself that you did nothing wrong. You didn't let your baby down, and the loss is not your fault. Keep that in mind whether or not you find out the cause of the miscarriage. Coping with repeat miscarriages. Suffering a single pregnancy loss can be hard enough to cope with, but if you've suffered more than one, you may find it infinitely harder, with each loss hitting you a little harder than the last. You may be discouraged, depressed, angry, irritable, and/or unable to focus on everyday life or on anything beyond your losses. The healing of your psyche may not only take a lot longer than the healing of your body, but the sadness can be debilitating. What's more, the emotional pain may lead to physical symptoms, including headaches, appetite loss or overeating, insomnia, and overwhelming fatigue. Some couples handle even repeat losses more matter-of-factly, and that's completely normal too. Time may not heal all. There will always be a little piece of your heart that's been taken, but it will definitely help tremendously, eventually. In the meantime, knowledge can be powerful, finding out as much as you can about what may have caused your miscarriages and what you and your practitioner might be able to do to prevent another. But patience and support may be your best remedies. Sharing with others who have suffered through pregnancy losses, especially multiple losses, can help you feel less alone, as well as more hopeful. Most of all, try to let go of any feelings of guilt or self-blame. Too often, moms who've suffered multiple miscarriages see it as a failure of their bodies to accomplish the most fundamental of female functions. But miscarriages are not your fault. Instead, try to focus on how strong you've been, even if you haven't always felt that strong, and how determined you are to have a baby. The difficult process of coping. When you experience a pregnancy loss, you're not only grieving for a baby, but for the hopes, dreams, and potential of what you believed was to come, a life not yet lived. The grieving process, though difficult, is a tribute to that life and to the connection you made to your baby during the time in your womb, so allow it to happen. The following may also help you cope. Take the time you need. The grieving process usually has many steps, including denial and isolation, anger, depression, and acceptance. But everyone experiences grief differently and recovers differently. Don't rush the process, but don't prolong it either once you feel it's time to move on. Feel the way you need to. Maybe you'll feel irritable and short-tempered, anxious, depressed, or lonely and empty, even if you're surrounded with people who love you. Or maybe you'll feel fleeting sadness, then hopeful to try again. All of this is normal. Cry if you need to for as long and as often as you feel you need to. If you don't feel like crying, that can be just as valid and just as normal. Write about it. Journal your feelings, the sad ones, the anxious ones, The angry ones, the ones you don't feel you can share with anyone else. Let go of the guilt. Just about every mom who has lost a baby, no matter how early or how late, looks for a way to blame herself. Maybe you'll look back at everything you ate or drank, every time you threw up your prenatal vitamins or forgot to take them. Or you'll wonder whether it was the workout you did, or the sex you had, or the heavy box you lifted, or the stress at work. Maybe you'll agonize over whether it was the mixed feelings you had about being pregnant, especially if you didn't plan the pregnancy. Those self-blaming feelings are understandable, they're normal, they're all too common among women. But the truth is, your baby's loss was in no way your fault. You are not responsible. If you have a hard time letting go of guilt, turn to professional support. Recognize that fathers grieve too. Dads who have lost a baby are likely to feel as much grief as moms, only they may express and process it differently. Not only for the obvious reason, you carried the baby was lost in your body, but also because he is likely trying to be strong for you. Remember, for better or worse, that's how men are hormonally wired, culturally programmed, and traditionally raised. His feelings of pain may be compounded by frustration, even anger over not being able to do two of the things men often feel they're meant to do, again, for better or worse, protect and fix. He couldn't protect you and the baby you both created, and he can't fix what happened, ever. He may not cry, or he may try not to cry in front of you. He may be stoic, or he may withdraw, or he may try to distract himself with work or other activities. None of which means that he doesn't feel the same pain you feel, that the heartache isn't as real. If you sense that's the case with your partner, and when you feel you're able, encourage him to share what he's feeling with you. He may also find it helpful to talk with another father who's been through a loss, but understand if he doesn't want to talk about his feelings at all. Let him grieve in his way, as you are in yours. Take care of each other. Grief can be very self-absorbing. You and your partner may find yourselves so consumed by your own pain that you don't have the emotional reserves left to comfort each other. But remember, you made this baby together, you lost this baby together, and you'll heal best if you grieve for this baby together. Although there will almost certainly be times when you'll want to be alone with your thoughts, also make time for sharing them with your spouse. Consider seeking grief counseling together too, which is often more beneficial than individual counseling, or join a couple support group. It may not only help you both find comfort, but also help preserve and even deepen your relationship. Don't face the world alone. If you're dreading the friendly faces asking about the baby, take a friend who can field questions the first few times you face the world. Be sure that those at work and at other places you go frequently are told about your loss so you don't have to do any more explaining than necessary. Realize that some friends and family may not know what to do or say. Some may be so uncomfortable that they withdraw. Others may say things that hurt more than help, like, "Oh, you can have another baby." Though they certainly mean well, they may not understand that another baby can never take the place of the one you lost, and that parents can become attached to a baby long before birth. If you're frequently hearing comments that hurt, ask a close friend or relative to let others know that you would rather they just say they are sorry about your loss. Look for support from those who've been there. You may find comfort in a local or online support group for parents who've lost infants. Try CompassionateFriends.org or NationalShare.org. But try not to let such a group become a way of holding on to rather than letting go of your grief. Take care of yourself. In the face of emotional pain, your physical needs may be the last thing on your mind. They shouldn't be. Eating right, getting enough sleep, and exercising are vital not just to maintaining your health, but also in aiding your recovery. So is taking a break from grieving once in a while to see a movie or have dinner out. If you feel that getting your life back to normal would somehow be disloyal, it may be helpful to ask your baby, and spirit for permission to enjoy life again. You might try doing it in a letter to your baby. For life to go on, after all, you need to go on living. Turn to religion if you find it comforting. For some grieving parents, faith is a great solace. For others, a tragedy can have them questioning their faith. And for still others, religion is not the answer, but spirituality may be. Again, it is your grief, your choice. Expect the pain to lessen over time. At first, there may only be bad days, then a few good days mixed in. Eventually, there will be more good days than bad. But remember that the grieving process, which may include nightmares and fleeting flashbacks, has no fixed timetable. It may not be fully complete for 2 years, but the worst is usually over after 2 to 6 months, and for some, it may take only a matter of weeks. If after 6 to 9 months, your grief remains the center of your life, if you're having trouble functioning or focusing, or have little interest in anything else, seek help.
A surrogate pregnancy, a personal loss. Surrogacy is often referred to as the gift of life for couples who can't conceive a baby together and/or aren't able to carry a pregnancy. But just as pregnancies conceived the traditional way sometimes end in miscarriage or stillbirth or the loss of one twin, so do surrogate pregnancies. If you've experienced the loss of a surrogate pregnancy, it can be just as real, just as deeply painful as if you'd lost a baby you were carrying. And if you've lost pregnancies before turning to surrogacy, it may seem like an extra cruel twist of fate. Surrogacy was the miracle that was finally going to bring you the baby or babies you and your partner longed for but couldn't have naturally. The financial investment may have been large, but the emotional investment far larger. Though the loss didn't happen in your body, and even if the pregnancy wasn't conceived with your egg or with your partner's sperm, you are entitled to feel all the same emotions any couple experiencing a loss might feel, from heartbreak to anger and resentment, even toward the surrogate, to guilt. And you are entitled to grieve in any way you need to. Use this chapter to help you through the process.
Coping with loss during or after birth. Sometimes the loss of a baby occurs during labor or delivery, sometimes just after delivery. Either way, your world comes crashing down. You've waited for, prepared for, anticipated, and expected this baby for months. And now you're going home without your baby. There's probably no greater pain than that inflicted by the loss of a child. And though nothing can completely heal the hurt you're feeling, there are steps you can take now to lessen the inevitable sadness that follows such a tragedy. See your baby, hold your baby, name your baby. Grieving is a vital step in accepting and recovering from your loss, and it's difficult to grieve for a nameless baby you've never seen. Even if your baby has malformations, experts advise that it is better to see him or her than not to, because what is imagined is usually worse than the reality. Holding your baby will make the death more real to you and ultimately easier to accept. So will doing some of those simple firsts that otherwise would never be. Giving a bath, putting on a diaper, dressing and swaddling your baby, combing his or her hair, cuddling, kissing. Take time to focus on the details you'll want to remember later. Big eyes and long lashes, a button nose, beautiful hands and delicate fingers, a head full of hair. If you have chosen a name for your baby, use it. If you haven't, consider doing that now so you'll have a name for the baby you'll want to remember always. Get the support you need. There are bereavement doulas who specialize in helping grieving parents cope. Hospitals also have grief counselors who can help too. Ask for the help you need. Don't rush the goodbye if you don't want to. Ask for and take the time you need. Some hospitals may offer cuddle cots, cooling systems that allow parents more time to spend with their babies and say their goodbyes. Collect mementos of your baby. Take photos or consider having portraits taken. NowILayMeDownToSleep.org can help with that. And consider preserving baby's handprint and footprint and a lock of hair, so you'll have some tangible reminders to cherish in the future. You will be asked for permission to conduct genetic tests and possibly an autopsy on your baby. If you opt to go ahead with these, try not to avoid the facts, as hard as they are to hear. Discuss autopsy findings and other medical reports with your practitioner to help you accept the reality of what happened and to help you in the grieving process, as well as to help you make decisions about future pregnancies. Ask friends or relatives to leave the preparations you made for baby at home. Coming home to a house that looks as though a baby was never expected will only make it more difficult to accept the reality of what has happened. It's better if you pack away those things yourselves. Remember your baby as privately or publicly as you need to. Arrange for a funeral and for burial or cremation, which will give you another important opportunity to say goodbye. But when it comes to a memorial service, do whatever feels right to you. That might be a completely private ceremony, which allows you and your spouse to share your feelings alone, or one that surrounds you with the love and support of family, friends, and community. Honor your child's memory in a way that has meaning to you, if that helps. Plant a tree or a new flower bed in your backyard or in a local park. Buy books for a child care center that serves kids in need, or donate to an organization or clinic that helps at-risk expectant and new moms, or one that builds playgrounds. Coping with the loss of one twin. Parents who lose one twin or more babies in the case of triplets or quads face celebrating a birth or births and mourning a death or deaths at the same time. If this happens, you may feel too conflicted to either mourn your lost baby or enjoy your living one, both vitally important processes. Understanding why you feel the way you do may help you better cope with your feelings, which may include all or just some of these. You may feel heartbroken. You've lost a baby, and the fact that you have another doesn't minimize your loss. Remember that you're entitled to mourn the baby you've lost, even as you're celebrating your other baby's birth. In fact, mourning that loss is an important part of the healing process. Taking the steps for grieving parents described in the previous sections can help you accept your baby's death as a reality. You may be happy too, but ambivalent about showing it. It may seem somehow inappropriate to be excited about the arrival of your surviving baby, or even disloyal to the one who didn't live. That's a natural feeling, but one you'll need to try to let go of. Loving and nurturing the sibling is a wonderful way of honoring your lost baby. Besides, it's essential to your living baby's well-being. You may want to celebrate, but not know if it's okay to. A new baby is always something to celebrate, even when the happy news comes with sadness. If you're uncomfortable holding a baby welcoming event without acknowledging your loss, consider first holding a memorial ceremony or a farewell for the baby who has passed away. You may view your baby's death as punishment, perhaps because you really weren't sure you wanted or could handle parenting multiples, or because you wanted a girl more than you wanted a boy, or vice versa. Though this kind of guilt is common among parents who experience a pregnancy loss of any kind, it's completely unwarranted. Nothing you did or thought or imagined or wished for could have caused the loss. You may feel disappointed that you won't be a parent of multiples. It's normal to be sad over the loss of this excitement, especially if you've been imagining and planning for the arrival of multiples for months. You may even feel twinges of regret when seeing sets of multiples. Don't feel guilty about feeling that way. It's completely understandable. You may be afraid that explaining your situation to family and friends will be awkward and difficult, especially if they've been eagerly awaiting the twins. To make facing the world a little easier, enlist a friend or close relative to spread the word so you won't have to. In the first few weeks, try to take someone with you when you go out with your baby so they can anticipate and answer the inevitable and possibly painful questions. you may have trouble handling the reactions and comments of family and friends. In trying to help, friends and family may overdo the excitement when welcoming your living child without acknowledging the one you've lost. Or they may urge you to forget your lost baby and appreciate your living one. As well-intentioned as their actions and words may be, they can hurt. So don't hesitate to tell people, especially the ones who are closest to you, how you feel. You may feel too depressed over your loss to care for your new baby, or if you're still pregnant, to care for your baby by taking the best possible care of yourself. Don't beat yourself up over your unhappy or conflicted feelings. They're normal and completely understandable. But do make sure that you get the help you need so you can start meeting your baby's needs, both physical and emotional. Support groups may help, and so can counseling. You may feel that you're alone in your pain. Getting support from others who know what you're going through can help more than you can imagine. Find that support in a local support group or online. You can contact Centers for Loss and Multiple Births, CLIMB, at climb-support.org. No matter what you're feeling, and given your situation, your feelings may be all over the emotional map. Give yourself time. Chances are you'll feel progressively better, and better about feeling better.
For dads, you're grieving too. You conceived a baby together. You celebrated the positive pregnancy test together. You watched ultrasound images together. Checked your pregnancy app for weekly updates on your baby's size and development, from blueberry to peach and maybe well beyond. Together, you planned and hoped and dreamed and imagined your life as parents, as a family of three or more. You guessed and maybe discovered baby's gender together, picked out names together, sorted through birth options, maybe even signed up for childbirth classes or baby registries. And then, in a moment, those plans and hopes and dreams were over. Whether it happened early or late in pregnancy, or whether it happened just before birth or just after, the baby you made together was gone, leaving both of you to grieve together, but probably in your own way. Grief over the loss of a baby takes many shapes and forms and levels of intensity, depending on so many factors, from how far along a pregnancy was, to how long it took to conceive, to whether the pregnancy was planned, but also on a parent's gender. Moms, it could easily be argued, grieve not only for the loss of the abstract, those visions and daydreams of life with baby, but also for the physically palpable loss. The baby you made together, after all, was growing inside her. Understandably, predictably, sympathy will be centered on her. The hugs, the condolences, the offers of help, even the medical care. The network of support will focus on holding her up, and you'll likely be part of it. Yes, she'll need that support, of course. But what about you? When do you get your chance to grieve? Here are some things to remember as you try to move forward. It's your loss too. People will probably say, "I'm so sorry she lost the baby." You may even find yourself calling the loss of the baby you made together her loss. For you to grieve and mend, though, you'll need to acknowledge that just as you made the baby together and planned to parent the baby together, you lost the baby together. You may have different ways of expressing and processing your grief, but it's your loss too. Your grief is your own. Everyone grieves differently after a pregnancy loss or a stillbirth, and that goes for moms and dads, which, by the way, those who've lost a pregnancy or a baby always will be. Loss can't take that away. Maybe you'll process it quickly, or maybe it will be slower in resolving. Maybe it'll be surprisingly intense, or far less so than you might have expected. There are no rules about how you should feel, or how long you should feel it. And that goes for your partner too. You can be strong and still be sad. Hormones wire men differently from women, but so do cultural expectations. And both of those can affect how you react to loss. You may find yourself shifting automatically into protector role, to be as strong as you need to be. Stronger still if your partner is especially vulnerable. The more she cries, the more you may feel compelled to hold in your tears, to put on a brave front. But as much as you can, try not to let that front keep your emotions from surfacing. By all means, be her rock. But crumble every now and then if you need to. Mostly, do what feels right. If you're sad, that's okay. If you need to cry, that's okay. If you're stoic, that's okay too. You can grieve more effectively together. Sometimes couples drift apart when they're mourning the loss of a pregnancy, but that isn't at all inevitable. Often, it's a matter of mixed signals and miscommunication. He's trying to be strong, and she takes that as a sign that the loss doesn't really mean much to him. She turns to others for support, and no one offers it to him. Or she gets so caught up in her own grief, and in the physical aftermath of the loss, she doesn't even realize that he's grieving too. But research shows that couples heal faster when they heal together. That the most effective way of conquering grief is to share it, not divide it. Even if you're finding face-to-face is hard at first, try to grieve side by side. Couples grief counseling can be especially effective. Know, too, that often grief brings couples closer to each other, and being in pain together can help you both better cope with and heal from your loss. You'll need to find your way. You're in this together, as you've been from the start, but you may need to find different outlets for your grief, too. Maybe you'll find it in your work, or in volunteer activities, or in exercise, or sports, or music, or nature. Maybe you'll find it in support from friends, especially those who know what you've been through. Or online from other fathers who've lost a pregnancy. Or maybe you'll find it in solitude. One place grieving fathers sometimes turn to is alcohol or recreational drugs. But while that can mask pain, remember that it won't ever resolve it, and that should be your ultimate goal. If you're experiencing signs of addiction or depression, get the help you need right away.
Palliative care for your baby. There are many hospitals, hospices, and clinics that provide hospice and palliative care support programs for families who wish to continue their pregnancies with babies who will likely be stillborn or not live long after birth. They offer care to the mother and the father and honor the baby with dignity and compassion. To find a list of these kinds of programs by state, go to perinatalhospice.org. If you've been told your baby may not live very long after birth, it may also be possible, once all life-saving efforts have been exhausted, to donate one or more healthy organs to a baby in need, and doing so may bring you some consolation for your own devastating loss. A neonatologist may be able to provide helpful information in such a situation and help you prepare physically and emotionally for it.
Trying again after pregnancy loss. Making the decision to try again for a new pregnancy and a new baby, often referred to as a rainbow baby, after a loss isn't always easy and definitely is not as easy as those around you might think. It's an intensely personal decision, and it can also be a painful one. Here are some things you might want to consider when deciding when or whether to try again. Trying again for another baby after losing one or more takes courage. Give yourself the credit you deserve and the pat on the back you need as you embark on this process. The right time is the time that's right for you. It may take just a short time for you to feel emotionally ready to try for another baby, or it may take a much longer time. Don't push yourself or let others push you into trying too soon. And don't second-guess yourself or paralyze yourself into waiting longer than you have to. Listen to your heart, and you'll know when you're emotionally healed and when you're ready to contemplate a new pregnancy. You'll need to be physically ready, too. Check with your practitioner to see whether a waiting period will be necessary in your case. Often, you can try as soon as you feel up to it and as soon as your cycle begins cooperating. In fact, studies have shown that women actually have a higher than normal fertility rate in the first 3 cycles after a miscarriage. If there's a reason why you have to wait longer than you want to, as may be the case after a molar pregnancy, use the time to get yourself into the best physical condition possible for conception, if you're not already. A new pregnancy may be less innocent. Now you know that not all pregnancies end happily, which means you probably won't take anything about your new pregnancy for granted. You may feel more nervous than you did the first time, especially until you've passed the anniversary of the week you lost your last baby. And if you lost your baby at or just before or after birth, you may worry more the entire time. You may try to keep your excitement in check, and you may find that your joy is tempered by trepidation, so much so that you may even hesitate to attach yourself to your new baby until that fear of loving and losing again has dissipated. You may be extra tuned in to every pregnancy symptom, the ones that give you hope, swollen breasts, morning sickness, those frequent runs to the bathroom, and those that trigger anxiety, those pelvic twinges, those crampy feelings. All of this is completely understandable and completely normal, as you'll find out if you reach out to others who've carried a new pregnancy to term after experiencing a loss. Just make sure that if these kinds of feelings keep you from nurturing and nourishing your new pregnancy, that you quickly get some help working them out. Looking forward to the ultimate reward, that baby you're so eager to cuddle, instead of looking back on your loss, will help you stay positive. Remember, the vast majority of women who have experienced a pregnancy loss or the loss of a baby go on to have completely normal pregnancies and completely healthy babies.
This has been an Audible Studios production of What to Expect When You're Expecting. 5th edition, written by Heidi Murkoff and Sharon Mazel, performed by Heidi Murkoff, with Megan Holloway, James Patrick Cronin, Christine Vam, Vanessa Johansson, Almarie Guerra, Sophia Willingham, Tanis Peranto, Inez Del Castillo, Emma Bing, Matt Viro, and Jasmine Walker. Executive producers, Susie Bright and Mike Charzik. Producer, Kat Lambrix. Directed by Megan Holloway, edited and mastered by Mark Galoop. Copyright 1984, 1988, 1991, 1996, 2002, 2008, 2016 by What to Expect, LLC. Sound recording copyright 2019 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.